The Holy Gospel according to Matthew.
Glory to you, O Lord.
Jesus made the disciples get into a boat and go on ahead to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone, but by this time the boat, battered by the waves, was far from the land, for the wind was against them. And early in the morning, Jesus came walking toward them on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified, saying, "It is a ghost." And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." Peter answered them, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." He said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat, started walking on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when Peter noticed the strong wind, he became frightened and began to sink. He cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and caught him, saying to him, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" When they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, Lord Christ.
Our first reading today paints Elijah as a new Moses, who experiences the living God upon the mountain. Horeb, of course, is another name for Mount Sinai. Then in Romans, Paul writes with authority and excitement, "How are people going to hear the good news if not for your actions, words, and presence to preach Christ throughout the world?" And then in the gospel, Peter fails his swimming test. It's understandable if you heard today's readings and thought that Elijah and Paul must have something quite figured out that Peter simply does not. But if we read back just a chapter in Kings, the narrative becomes much messier. We read from chapter 19 today, but in chapter 18, we find Elijah in a prophet face-off with the prophets of the god Baal. Then, on a different mountain, Mount Carmel, Elijah challenges Baal's worshippers to have Baal call down fire upon a sacrifice. When they fail to do so, Elijah calls on the God of the Israelites, who answers with the monumental fire before sending down powerful rains that end the drought plaguing the region. All of the Israelites, it says, were sent for to join this event, making it presumably a decent crowd. And in fact, when the Lord answers Elijah by sending down fire, all of the people fell on their faces and said, "The Lord indeed is God." Elijah then rather violently offs the prophets of Baal, and then he runs about 25 miles from Horeb to Jezreel at a rate faster than a horse-drawn chariot. Upon hearing about the elimination of Baal's prophets, Queen Jezebel, herself at Jezreel, sends a message to Elijah, promising him that she will ensure that he receives the same fate as the prophets of Baal. So Elijah, this bold, empowered prophet, a marathon runner of God, runs away into the wilderness and begs God to remove him from his role as a prophet. Elijah is sustained in the desert by God, but even still, he falls into despondency about the threats put to him by Jezebel. In this context, then, we arrive at Mount Horeb today, where Elijah tells the Lord, perhaps not with boldness, but with despair, "The Israelites have forsaken your covenant, I alone am left, and they are seeking my life." Certainly, Elijah's fear about being pursued by Jezebel makes a lot of sense, and we only have to look around our world all too easily today to see how terrifying it is to have political power wielded to endanger lives. But as the story is passed down to us, we also see Elijah swing from the absolute triumph of Mount Carmel to deep despair on Mount Horeb after he's just shown to the many that the Lord is God. In response, God provides the striking display: a wind that splits mountains, an earthquake, fire, and finally a sheer silence. Coming out to address the silence, Elijah is still despondent, though. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life. Something true and full of fear, but also fully opposite what we saw of Elijah a chapter before. Ultimately, God does not relinquish Elijah's calling as prophet, but instead sends him back out to pass on his mission, to anoint two kings, and to anoint Elisha as a prophet to replace Elijah. Now, in this light, Peter might look a little bit different. Even with Jesus standing before the boat, he stumbles forward in what is at least an echo of Elijah's stumbles. Initially sure of himself and ready to walk toward his Lord, Peter becomes aware of the real physical danger he's in, walking on top of a sea, but also, I think, he becomes aware of the mystery and the confusion of this moment in his calling. Is this person who called him away from a life of fishing on the sea, who now walks upon that water and calls him out over it, is this truly the Christ? Is this reality to be walking upon water toward the incarnate God? And when he is saved and the wind calms, he and the others in the boat worship Jesus as the Son of God. And of course, we know that the story ahead is still not a perfect icon of faith either. Over and over, Peter and the other apostles will try and fail, culminating with Peter's denial of Christ before Jesus is crucified. So Elijah struggled to return to his call as a prophet, even with God revealing herself in sheer silence. Peter struggled to follow the one he knew as Christ, even as that Christ stood before him, calling him at his own request out onto the water. And we all get to live in the ongoing era in which Paul writes today in the epistle. How are they to believe in one whom they have never heard? How are they to proclaim him unless they are sent? It must be so much easier for us today than it was for Elijah and Peter, right, to keep faith. But the reading from Romans nonetheless ends with a call toward the world, a call toward mission. Like Elijah in his time and Peter in his, we are called into something called mission, something that is at the heart of the life of discipleship as members of Christ's church. But mission means 1,000 things to 100 people. And if we look to Elijah and Peter today, we see that even those who might have the easiest time to move forward in mission often fail. They might find themselves going astray from their calling, they might lose hope in the face of danger, or even lose just momentary trust that the Christ toward whom we are walking is really the Christ. Mission, then, is not a cut and dry thing, and we cannot grasp it. Mission, instead, is a calling to us as individuals, as a community, to live in the promise of life abundant and to help realize the reign of God, a reign that ultimately is not and cannot be of our human, finite world alone. Just because Christ is before us, or at least because we think that Christ is before us, we don't necessarily have that guarantee that the particular way that we are moving toward Christ is indeed just or needed or perhaps even faithful. While we probably won't end up toe-to-toe with a host of rival prophets, we are likely to find ourselves in places where we are trying to preach the gospel by both word and action. And it may be the case that our human realities cause us to go about these words or actions in the wrong way, and indeed we will set out in the wrong way altogether at times. Without getting everyone too riled up, we in this community have a concrete example of this as we're working to raise the roof. Think of all the items that go into ensuring this building can continue as a setting for our mission. What color will the roof be? Will there be solar panels? Will things be changed from the 99 renovation? I have heard a lot about it, even as a newcomer. And as with so many things in the long journey of discipleship, whether it's choosing the wood stain or us choosing how to act against the injustices that abound in our world, we have so very many opportunities to miss the mark, to cling to a vision of the future or the past, to get hooked on our own understanding of God, of how God is calling us in this moment, and how we are to respond to that message. Turning back to our readings, although a great prophet, Elijah was not God. Though a great apostle, Peter was not God either. And although we are at least decent people, we are not God either. But still, we are called by this God to bring our hope into an ailing world. We are sent out not because we are perfect, but because our God is at work in this time, and we are to be collaborators in that work. To do the work, though, we ought to keep recalling that we ourselves are not God, and we cannot grasp this God. So we have to keep discerning in our actions so that they can be ever more aligned with how God is calling us to serve in this world. I don't say all this to suggest that there's a great cosmic test that we have to pass, nor to say that we have to make sure that we're nice and careful about what we do and we don't slip up in the path. I say this because Elijah, Peter, and Paul teach us today that we continue in a history of people throughout the centuries who tried to realize the reign of God as they were able, but who also swung from the highest highs to the deepest lows, who walked on water during an inhale and who had to be plucked from the sea on the exhale, a people who even so are called to join in the work of salvation, even as the powers of death grasp onto markets, government structures, companies, and perhaps even building projects. As followers of Christ, we still cannot grasp the fullness of God's vision of the world, but still we must keep moving forward. To do so, we need to pause. As Pastor Carrie said last week, we need to rest, and we need to discern whether we are still headed on the right path. We need to see what our compatriots on the journey are thinking, seeing, and feeling as we keep walking our pilgrim path as the people of God. And we will lose the path sometimes. We will grasp onto ideas and really think that we've got it right. We will sometimes think that everything has gone wrong and there's no reason to keep moving. But especially in those times, our readings today remind us that we are the torchbearers of a tradition of people of faith who needed to find a way to keep moving. Not because they or we are failures, but because we are witnesses to the future of God rather than owners of it in the present. So as we move forward today in our liturgy, as we gather in community here following it, and as we then move back into the world outside the building this week, I think we would do well to keep praying about the things we're doing, the way we are doing them especially, and work to discern where we seem to align with the spirit that animates our work and where we might still need to adjust our horizons. We will have things that need shaping, reshaping, and reforming, and some things we'll find are well-oriented and we can keep pursuing them. Just like Elijah and Peter and even Paul had some things right, I hate to say it, and some things that needed to grow and adapt. And from that quiet, remember that we are called out still into the world, not as individuals who have it all figured out and can fix everything to our perfect vision, but we are called out as people whom God has loved and whom God has called to a vision and mission greater than what we can imagine on our own. A mission that we inherited and that we someday will pass on, still incomplete, to new prophets, new teachers, new friends, and, God willing, new UniLU building committees and church councils. Amen.